This is Tech on the Marketplace Morning Report. I'm Ben Johnson. Colonel Chris Hadfield is probably the most famous Canadian astronaut ever. And after playing and shooting a music video of David Bowie's Space Oddity from the International Space Station and getting 18 million views on YouTube, he might be the most famous astronaut of our era. But Hadfield's story is also about farm life in Canada, about testing the limits of our aviation technology around the world, and about the behind-the-scenes journey to travel outside our atmosphere. It's all in his new book, An Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth. Colonel Hadfield, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Ben. It's nice to be here.
So your journey, you write in your book you always wanted to be an astronaut, but your journey sort of started as an engineer, right? So I'm curious, what's the first piece of technology that's really fascinated you, made you want to take it apart and put it back together?
I grew up on a farm, and so I've been taking tractors apart. And, I mean, rebuilding the whole transmission of a tractor, it's just as long as I can remember. I hung around. My dad would send us over to the corner of a shop with a piece of wood and nails, and you could learn to hammer nails into a piece of wood and then pull them out again and do that over and over. And working on cars, probably my first was really cars. I had a 62 Oldsmobile with a rocket engine in it and was a lot of fun. And
what does that mean? What is a rocket engine?
That's what they called it, a rocket. A 292 rocket is a big motor and not very gas efficient, but you know, a fun first car. It was an old car when I got it. But just learning how machinery works, how things work has always really fascinated me. And I that's why I studied engineering. And when I became a test pilot, for me, that was kind of the whole mix of everything that I loved, of machinery, of operating it, of really understanding not only what it was supposed to do, but how to make it work and how to make it do those things better. And I learned that right from the first time I drove a tractor down a field on a farm.
There's a good story in your book about you taking that tractor to the limits and breaking the tractor and your dad telling you to go get the weld tools out and fix it.
Yeah.
But your work as a test pilot is really interesting to me because this, as I understand it, I didn't know that much about this area before reading some of your book, but this is the idea that we need to basically push some of our most powerful technology to the edge in order to understand how it works when things break. Tell me more about that.
Well, I mean, it's sort of a metaphor for life as well. If you stay right in the middle of your comfort envelope, you're not going to learn very much. But when you take what you think you're good at or something that you don't really understand and you start pushing it right to the edges of the envelope, the edges of where someone on a chart has drawn that you can take this thing, altitude or speed or angle of attack or whatever, that's where you really start to learn something new, where you really push it. And I did all sorts of projects. I've flown nearly 100 different types of airplanes, but I was primarily a test pilot with the U.S. Navy. And when I was a test pilot there, we did high angle of attack work. I did my master's thesis on how to evaluate an airplane when it's flying right at the edge of its control envelope with the nose up in the air. How do you evaluate it to tell whether this is a good behavior, a bad behavior? How do you know to quantify it so when an engineer makes a small change, you can tell him, yeah, this was better, this was worse? How to really figure out right at the edge of control how to make things better? And that's hugely gratifying for me. And we had some really big changes to how F-18s fly to stop them crashing and to make them more controllable for the people in the pilot seat.
Like what? Give me an example.
There were – especially the two-seat F-18, of course, it's got a bigger canopy because there's two people in there. So it's it makes the airflow around the F-18 quite different. The center of pressure moves. And so the airplane is less stable under some flight regimes. People were crashing them. And we call it departing, where you depart controlled flight.
Okay.
You know, that's basically right. Means going out of control. The airplane does something that no matter what you do with your feet and your hands, the airplane is doing something wildly different. We found several places in what we thought was the known envelope where the airplane would go out of control. Something as simple as pushing forward on the stick so the airplane was sort of floating and standing on one rudder. And it would take off just crazy. And so we convinced the Navy that We ought to be able to go test this. Took a couple years to convince them. But finally they said
– As it okay, should. Those, yeah, those planes right. are expensive.
Yeah. yeah. And we convinced them we wouldn't crash one. And normally you'd put a huge rescue parachute on the back, a right. drag chute. But those are expensive and you would have had to modify the structure of the airplane to take it. So we had to convince them we weren't going to crash one even without a rescue chute. Convinced them, got in it. I got to be the first guy. It was my project. Got to be the first pilot up there. So I'm kind of like, oh, man, big talker. Here we go. But I did it once, survived. And then we started just getting wilder and wilder. Out of the whole thing, we rewrote the book on how to recover an F-18 when it gets out of control. And then more importantly, we found that by taking one parameter of flight, which is your beta, your side slip, and feeding that back into the flight control system, the computers that control the way it flies, you could make the airplane immensely more predictable and controllable. And now you have even more carefree handling. You can make that airplane, bury the stick in your lap, pull 60 degrees angle of attack where your nose is pointed 60 degrees higher than where you're actually going and still control and fly the airplane. It's an amazing result, and we helped do that through the stuff I studied and learned my whole life and the team that was working on it.
Your book sort of follows – the beginning of your book follows your path to becoming an astronaut, which I think is kind of interesting because you come up basically during the Cold War.
Right.
And then you end up working with Russian cosmonauts, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Living there.
So are there cultural differences between the way that we think about technology in the U.S. and the way that people in that part of the world think about technology and use it and interact with it? I remember, you know, there's a part where you're talking about the Falcon suit that they put you in, which is this suit, right, that you jump into the air with. But
yeah, I thought about that having come from the background I came from and then looking at their system. Obviously, they're immensely successful. They put the first human being in space, the first satellite in space. They built the first space station. You know, their engineering is not the same, but it's very efficient, very capable. So I looked at it. I'm going, what do they do right? What do they do wrong? My conclusion was that in Russian almost philosophy of engineering, better is the enemy of good enough. Whereas the culture I grew up in North America here, better is better. You know, if you can come up with something better, then forget that old design. You know, let's forget Apollo. Let's build the shuttle. You know, let's start over. Let's build a new thing like we're doing again right now. We've finished flying the shuttle. Now we're going all over again with Orions. The Russians came up with a really beautiful, elegant design, their initial spaceship, and some wonderfully clever little things they thought of that are just so good. And they flew it, and then they flew it again, and then they flew it again, and they went, well, let's change this one thing. And then they flew it again and again. Okay, let's change two more things. And their evolution of the Soyuz, which is the spaceship that I flew last year, it's almost like a sculpture where you have had a master in who's looked at the sculpture and thought about it and then chipped away just a tiny little piece and chipped away another little piece. But the basic sculpture then just tends to improve and refine over time. And it doesn't lead to something like the space shuttle, which was the most capable flying machine ever built. And 3/4 of everybody who ever flew in space flew on the shuttle. I'd count myself so lucky to have flown on an immensely capable human invention. And it served its purpose brilliantly. On the other hand, the Russians have the Soyuz, which also does a good job and takes people to the station and back tough and simple and reliable and predictable. Hmm. And that has an elegance all its own. So the two different philosophies, they both come up with products and they both serve their purposes, but their end products definitely look different as a result.
Let's talk about your time in space. You have been, I think, a sort of wonderful ambassador for human life in space. You're showing people whether or not you can cry in space. You're, you know, showing them how to make food in space.
Sure.
Your music video for David Bowie's Space Odyssey, you know, is viewed almost 20 million times now. How do you think your time in space has been different because of new technology than, I don't know, the guys who walked on the moon?
My first flight in space was a long time ago. It was almost 20 years ago. I helped build the Russian space station Mir. On that flight, I was just as motivated to try and share the experience with everybody around the world. But the technology had not been invented yet. I had film cameras. It was 1995. I had a film camera. It takes I take a beautiful picture, say, of Manhattan, a gorgeous picture of Manhattan. It was in November. And so I have this beautiful picture of Manhattan. Now it takes 10 days to get back home again, and then I ship it off to the film lab and they take 10 days to process it, and then they ship it over and then we sort through it and we try to choose, oh, that one looks okay. Then you send it back to the lab and they make me a 35 millimeter slide of it. And now I have to travel to Manhattan and find someone who wants to see my picture and have a big screen and slide it into the projector and go ka-chunk, ka-chunk, and go, look, there's Manhattan. Now on the space station, I can see the island here on a beautiful day, snap a picture, float down the space station, stick it in, write something about it like, look at the shadows on the Hudson from the town. I mean, it's gorgeous. And within minutes, a million people can look at it if they want to. And the millions of people that do follow along have just sort of an invitation. I'm not trying to force anything on them. I'm just saying, look what you can see if you look through my eyes. That technology of connectivity, both through the digital cameras that make it real time, but also the link of communications between the space station. So I'm basically online. It's slow dial-up, but it's still online from the space station. And then the technology of something like Twitter, which then spreads it so rapidly around the world, those allow people on board in an unprecedented way. And the results speak for themselves. You can see a significant change in the slope of the curve of the number of people that go to NASA's science sites directly as a result of the technology that brought people on board. It had a big impact, and it would be interesting to follow on and see now what some people choose to do, what courses they choose to take, what decisions they choose to make based on the fact that look what is possible. Mm-hmm. And people make their own life choices based on the things that they see in front of them.
Are you aware of Reddit? Are you on, you know, are you?
I've been on Reddit for years. I didn't ask me anything from orbit. I did an AMA in quarantine.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
And I did an AMA from the space station, in fact. So, I'm on Reddit today.
What do you think about that format for kind of bringing your gospel as an astronaut to, I don't know, the rest of the world that doesn't get to spend the time that you've spent or spend $40 million to put themselves into space?
When I was growing up, I was really interested in a few things. I was fascinated by archaeology, fascinated by geology, and fascinated by spaceflight. But as a kid growing up on a farm, you know, apart from Encyclopedia Britannica, where do I and waiting for the next month's version of National Geographic, where am I getting my real-time info? If there'd been something like Reddit available then, the ability not only to share my interest with other people that have the same sort of interests, but also to invite in an astronaut or a real expert who can then directly answer my question and then the questions of other like-minded people, but not just in a shotgun noisy way, but in a way that is sort of evolutionary, in that the questions that most people share are the ones that rise to the top. And that's a really clever idea, and I really like the way that Reddit is self-policing just by its very nature. So I think it's a wonderful way, and it's social media with the real accent on social. So much of media is a bullhorn. You know,
I know very well.
Buy my soap, you know, buy my soap. That's what a lot of media is.
Yeah.
It's so nice in social media, which is more, we are all connected. Have a look at what I'm doing if you choose to. And if you're interested, continue to follow what's going on here. That is a more natural communication means. And something like Reddit is a really nice community within that allows people to follow what is their natural bent.
Got two more questions for you. Your book, there's a lot of really just sort of wonderful personal history in your book about you and your family and sort of the difficulty of getting to the places that you've been, literally and figuratively.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a lot of impressive stuff in there. Tell me about the things that have terrified you. Tell me about the hardest times in your career that have been really difficult. I mean, you're a guy who flies planes,
sure,
almost
sure,
crashing them. What scares you? You know,
I've had a couple times in airplanes where I came within a gnat's whisker of dying. Probably the one that was the quickest and the scariest was at Pax River in Maryland when I was a test pilot, and we'd changed the whole nose of the F-18. So you have to change all of its air sensors to tell you how high you are and how fast you are, and then you have to calibrate them somehow. The way you actually do it is you fly by low at an exact altitude at a bunch of different speeds, and there's like a telescope, a theodolite on the ground that measures your exact height, and you compare it to the height you see in the cockpit. And from that, you can calibrate your system. It's pretty elegant mathematics and engineering. But what that means as the pilot, what it really boils down to, is you have to fly really low over the Chesapeake, like 50 feet above the water, at everything from 150 knots up to 550 knots. I'm at the final test point. I'm 50 feet above the Chesapeake flying by this point. I'm 50 feet and 550 knots ripping across the water. And just as I'm coming up on the theodolite, I'm doing a countdown. I'm going to say 3, 2, 1, mark. I go 3, 2, and as I'm about to say 1, I see a seagull in front of me. And I'm doing 550 knots. That's 9 miles a minute. It's a mile every whatever.
How did you even see
8 seconds. Well, he just I could just see a speck, and he was just in my little heads-up display velocity vector, and he was very slightly high on me, which meant, of course, I wanted to bunt forward to miss him. So I was just about to push forward on the stick, but I was at 50 feet, so that would have been a bad idea. So I flinched a little bit, and I heard a bang off the airplane, and I thought he'd gone down my left engine.
Right,
and
which is
so
bad news.
Oh, which is really bad. So I pulled the engine to idle. I didn't even want to look at it. Pulled the engine to idle, popped up all that energy, called an emergency, aborted pretty close to the airfield there, brought it up and around, landed at Pax River on one engine, thinking, okay, good, I lived. Because if he had been a foot over to the right, he would have come right through the canopy. And at 550 knots, he'd be like a cannonball. He would have come right through it and killed us both. Landed and we couldn't find a mark on the airplane, not a mark. I'm going, there was nothing down the intake. I know he hit me. I heard. And the next morning, a technician walking around the airplane on the inside of the vertical tail, way up high at the back, he saw some discoloration. Yeah. And it had collapsed a whole bunch of the honeycomb on the inside of the vertical tail, and they had to get in and do a bunch of structural repair. Could have lost a tail off the airplane if we'd done some high alpha work. So,
wow.
So that moment, just, you know, a foot's difference in where I'd been or where that poor seagull had been would have been the end of it. So it's one of those things you just go, that was close. And thank you, St. Christopher or whatever, for protecting me on this particular travel.
A lot of people talk about how just the power of the perspective of Earth when you're in space or in near orbit, and talk about how that changes your perspective as a human being about all of us. Do you think that if everyone could see that, it would change the way that we behave towards each other?
On a spaceship, you have to go fast to stay in orbit. It's a blessing and a curse. It means you need an immensely powerful rocket to get you going fast enough. Otherwise, you just fall back to Earth. So you have to get going 5 miles a second. 5 miles a second from San Diego to Boston in 9 minutes, you know, 16 times around the world every day. But you orbit the world every 90 minutes or every 92 minutes. That's the blessing, because you can see the whole world in an hour and a half. You know, some people commute that far each way every day. In that time, the space station goes around the world. And as you're going around the world in sort of a fixed orbit, like a ball on the end of a string, the world turns underneath you. So every time you come around, it's a different part of the planet. And you're in the darkness because you're in the shadow of the world. And then you come into a sunrise. and you come around the light side of the world, then back into darkness again. So you get 16 sunrises and 16 sunsets. And at first you just kind of see the world like disconnectedly. It's just the world and you're looking at it and it's sort of like looking at a globe or a map or thumbing through the National Geographic. After a while though, you start to get familiar with it. The difference between driving through a city you don't know and then driving through a city you really know. And you start to look forward for parts of the world and, and the lighting changes and the seasons change and you just start to see the world as one big continuum. And I started to see cities the same way in that our patterns of settlement are the same worldwide. We find a place that is hospitable and we live there. And that sense of connectedness starts to become pervasive within yourself. You start to realize that this repeated pattern is a real clear evidence of the shared humanity of us all. You can't avoid feeling that way after a while. And I found after a month or two up there when I was sending a tweet, you know, here's a picture of Karachi, Pakistan, and this is where 7 million of us live. And I didn't even think about it, but this is where 7 million of us, or I don't think that's the right number, but of us live. And you just start to see the whole world as just us living in different places. And that gets internalized into you. And I'm no sort of dupe. I'm not thinking that things are easy,
right?
Or that
you work for the Navy.
Matter.
You've worked for the Navy.
I used to intercept Soviet bombers off the coast of North America for NORAD. I understand. At the same time, though, that sense of collectivity, of the fact that we all live in this little sliver of habitable zone between the vacuum of space and the heat of the magma. We have this little crust of the earth that we live on, the cooled part, and half the atmosphere is in the first 3 miles. We're unlivable above 3 miles basically. We live in this little tiny zone and we live there together. And the same feeling I sort of had about my crew on board our spaceship, you start to think about the entire crew living aboard the spaceship that is our planet. And it's – I really like how it makes me feel. There's a sense of kinship and a natural tendency towards friendship with everybody else because you feel like you're in this together. And I think almost everybody could benefit from seeing the world that way. And that's why I tried so hard to share it. It's why I took all those pictures. It's why I sent them down to everybody I could because I really think that's a healthy perspective for everybody to have. If they can just see the world through these eyes, maybe it'll help them make better decisions and not just greedy local decisions. And I know it's just one small holding up one little barrier against a big wind, but it didn't hurt and it might help. And for me, it was an immensely deepening experience and good experience to see the world that way.
Colonel Chris Hadfield is the author of the book An Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth. Colonel, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Ben. Nice to talk with you.
I brought that guitar for a reason.
Okay.
I have a keyboard.
Where's your keyboard? I just have it here under my desk.
Just have it here under my desk.
Cool. I'll get the guitar.
If you want that. Thank you.
Not bad for throwing it together.
Best we've ever done that. Nice.